This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition of Mac Format Investigation.
They have responded. It has taken them an awful long time to do so, though, and there's a lot of disgruntled, really quite frustrated users.
Chris Finn investigates claims that Apple's online service isn't delivering. And we look at the BBC iPlayer.
The iPlayer project is actually right on the mark. We have no interest of it not being available on platforms that have a significant amount of our users.
Is the corporation's offering a stripped-down version to Mac users? The BBC fights back. All that and more coming up on this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hi again, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. Since July of 2002, Apple has touted the value of its online service known as .Mac. It began by offering email access along with a personal web hosting service and online disk storage service. In the past 6 years, the service has grown in features and popularity worldwide. In August of this year, Apple upped the combined email and file storage limit to 10 gigabytes and 100 gigabytes of monthly data transfer. But for years, .Mac has been plagued by criticism of its real value. At £69 for a basic one-year membership, .Mac has never lowered its price and added small benefits and features. Now comes criticism from the service's European subscribers who claim that Apple's online service is failing to deliver value for the money, primarily in the area of poor access speeds. Mac Format has spent the past 4 months investigating these claims of slow access and transfer speeds and finding that for many, .Mac access in Europe is not up to, shall we say, speed. Mac Format Deputy Editor Chris Finn looked into the allegations, and he joins us now to tell us what he found and what he reported in the December issue of the magazine, as well as some new news that has come from Apple just recently. Chris joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hello there, Brad. How are you doing?
Very good. Let's get into your article, which appears on page 20 in the December issue. How did this all come about? How did you find out that this really was an issue for European subscribers to .Mac?
It first came about, actually, from emails from our readers, because we'd been obviously using the iLife system since it came out and the iLife 08 stuff that used the web gallery features in .Mac. And since they started coming out, we started putting them through their paces. We started noticing there was some sluggishness, but then we started getting a raft of emails from our readers writing in saying that they, too, were finding out that things were going wrong. And actually, there was a big thread started on Apple's own discussion forums which discussed these problems.
And what were these problems, basically?
As you said, it's speed. I mean, the figures that were being reported was that if you're accessing .Mac web galleries in Europe, now this is specifically about .Mac web galleries, not about iDisk or email or anything like that. It was just the web galleries that were introduced in iLife 08.
Right.
And the accusations are that the speeds were being somehow throttled or capped for European users. People were seeing download speeds of around 78 kilobytes a second. Now, 78K, considering that if you're on, let's say, a 4 megabit broadband line, that should be capable of 512 kilobytes a second. And even allowing for the usual things like overheads, contention ratios, and the fact that there could be more people accessing that particular site at the one time than just you, 80k a second does seem a little bit low.
And do you think that from what you know about .Mac speeds, that these numbers were correct that people were reporting and that there really is something wrong?
Well, certainly the results that were being reported seemed to be genuine. They were being reported by people who I would have thought were fairly tech-savvy. They were being reported in such a way as I had no reason to doubt the veracity of them. And the testing that we carried out ourselves seemed to bear out the figures people were getting as well, including when we did some testing in the States with some of our contributors there. And to address the second part of your question, yes, I mean, they seem to be perfectly legitimate complaints. The speeds did seem to be slow. One thing I would take issue with, people were saying the speeds were throttled, suggesting that Apple had deliberately and maliciously slowed down access in Europe. I don't think that was the case. I think it was just that there was a problem somewhere in the infrastructure that Apple had put in place that it was having trouble resolving. One of the things that makes me think that is that Apple was inviting feedback from users, and it was asking people to get in touch with them, report their findings, and it was gathering data in that way to try and, I think, to try and fix the problem themselves. I just don't think Apple realized what the problem was.
Now, we should tell people that Chris did contact Apple numerous times to to get some response for this story to find out what the problem was. His emails and phone calls went unanswered from Apple. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were trying to evade the issue. They certainly were looking into it. And since your article, they have responded. So tell us what's happened.
That's right. If you look in your Enhanced podcast now, you'll see a link to a discussion point on Apple's own forums. Apple has now made an announcement to say that they've put some processes in place to improve the access speeds for .Mac web galleries. Now, again, it's only a partial answer, because what they've done is they've apparently improved the access speeds for photo galleries. And right enough, from what people are seeing and from the reports that we're getting, they do seem to have done that. However, the movie galleries are still a little bit sluggish, and they haven't addressed anything with the movie galleries. I'll just say that on their discussion point that we're directing you to now. So they have responded. It has taken them an awful long time to do so, though, and there's a lot of disgruntled, really quite frustrated users during that time. Not necessarily because they wanted to get the services working for themselves, although that certainly was the case for a few of them, but mostly because you're paying for a premium service, and you do expect a premium level of service,
right.
And that was something that Apple hadn't been delivering on.
So you say they've addressed the issue, but they in some ways haven't. Exactly what do you mean there?
So they've improved the photo gallery load times, but they say on their announcement, we have not made any changes to web gallery movies or any other .Mac services at this time, suggesting that they've still got some work to do.
Or they don't feel there is a problem at all.
That's a possibility, but I think there's a fair few people in that original discussion forum, which, as I say, got over 20,000 views, that would disagree with that stance.
All right, now Chris, for those out there who are not happy with .Mac for whatever reason, there's got to be some other alternatives to .Mac, and I know that there are that you mentioned in the article. Tell us about some of those.
Okay, so let's break it down. If you're looking at mail, unless you actually specifically want an @mac.com email address, there's tons and tons and tons of different options. One of the best, obviously, is Gmail, and that has recently, since I wrote this article, started rolling out IMAP access as well as POP access for its email system. Although you could look at companies like MacAce.net, which is a Mac-friendly ISP. iDisk, MediaMax is great. It doesn't have the same integration with the OS and with the Finder as the iDisk does, but you get 25 gigabytes of storage online for free. Photo galleries, the obvious thing is Flickr, but there's others as well. If you look at social media sites like Facebook, you can share photographs on there, which are tagged in a similar way as they are on Flickr. You can also upload HTML galleries, and there's a bunch of iPhoto plugins as well that will allow you to export quickly and easily from iPhoto directly to these services. Video galleries, nothing's as polished as .Max is. The obvious solution is YouTube, but it's a little bit grainy and low quality for my liking. There's a bunch of them which are competitor services to YouTube, things like Metacafe or Vimeo. Vimeo is a good one, that's Vimeo.com, and they've started allowing the upload and display and stream of high definition movies, which look cracking. If you're looking to synchronize data between different Macs, there's an app called Sync Together, which is a one-off payment of $50, and then you can synchronize your information between different Macs very simply. And if you are missing the Groups feature that's built into the new .Mac, then you can go to sites such as Yahoo or Google, both of which allow you to create online groups and manage them in the same way as you do with .Mac.
But the bad news here, Chris, is that none of these are integrated together in one like .Mac.
That's absolutely right. With .Mac, you've got one sign-in, one login, and once you've punched that into the system preference pane in Mac OS X, everything else is taken care of for you, and it's seamless. Here, you've got a mishmash of different services. Some things like web standards are helping to make the crossover an awful lot easier. But you're right, it's a disparate set of services. However, it depends how you want to balance your costs, because most of the services that I've talked about are free, and .Mac is £70 a year. You've got to be able to balance that off and justify that cost to yourself. How much is convenience worth for you?
Wrapping up, let's talk about .Mac just for a second. Based upon these issues and what we're seeing in terms of value for your money, when you look at .Mac yourself from a journalistic standpoint as well as a user, what do you think the value is of .Mac in terms of what people are getting?
Ironically, the value is that it is a premium service. I mean, I was an iTools subscriber before it morphed into .Mac, and since ever the iTools idea was mooted, and since ever the idea was actually brought into play when it became .Mac, it has actually really improved. And you look at the webmail access, which is ad-free, you look at the ability to use your IMAP folders and sync things between different computers, you look at the syncing between the personal information stuff that you have on different computers, and the fact you've now got 10 gig of storage, they have actually made it a much more appealing prospect. It's just annoying that problems like this keep cropping up and give it a bad name.
Chris, thanks so much for going over these issues regarding .Mac.
My pleasure, Brad.
Chris Finn's investigation of .Mac services in Europe is on page 20 in the December issue of Mac Format. In October, the BBC announced it would launch a streaming version of its iPlayer for the Mac and Linux so users could watch BBC programming on their computers as well as on their televisions. The corporation signed a deal with Adobe to bring Flash streaming to all of its video services, including the iPlayer, a software video player similar to QuickTime. But the announcement doesn't include the full download services being offered to Windows XP users, so Mac users can't store BBC programs on their local hard disk and watch without needing a continuous internet connection. With the Mac product expected to be available in a few weeks, I spoke with Eric Huggers, the BBC's controller of the Future Media and Technology Group, to get further insight on the announcement for Mac users. Mr. Huggers, after years of development, the BBC Trust having to push the corporation into developing a Mac version, and then the news that it will be a watered-down version that allows only streaming, some might say that the iPlayer project is off the mark. Is that a fair comment?
I think that's not a fair comment at all. I think that the iPlayer project is actually right on the mark, and we've always said that, you know, downloading was going to be the first service that we were going to go out with. We've launched that in beta, and we've looked at what the market is doing, and we've looked at the interest of consumers in having what I would call, I guess, instant gratification, and we've said, okay, streaming was always on the agenda, and so adding streaming to a downloading proposition seemed to make a lot of sense. On top of that, we've decided to go with a set of technologies that give us instant cross-platform capabilities. Plus, you know, with the Adobe announcement, which I'm sure you have, which I'm sure you've seen, we get the commitment from Adobe to move to open industry standards for encoding, standards such as H.264, AAC, etc. And those are all very attractive things for us.
Now, the BBC Trust made it a condition of approval for the on-demand service that the iPlayer be available to users on a range of platforms, but it didn't specifically say that all platforms should offer the same level of delivery. So do you feel that by offering only streaming to Mac users in the beginning and not downloading like you're offering to Windows users, that the BBC is playing fast and loose with the definition of the word access?
No, I don't think that is the case either. I think that, as I said earlier, we've always been committed to offering this service across multiple platforms and in multiple ways. We are still very keenly investigating whether it is feasible for us to offer both the downloading and the streaming service, obviously is now going to be available come the end of the year, but offer the download service to a variety of platforms beyond Windows as well. Truth is that the Windows platform today has obviously a lot of reach, and that was one of the key things for the BBC to go with that platform first. Second, I think it's important to realize, and not this gets overlooked, I think, a lot, is that we as the BBC have to protect the content using DRM technologies. And the DRM technologies that are available on the Windows platform are not necessarily as readily available on other platforms. On top of that, even if there were other DRM solutions available, for example, the FairPlay technologies that Apple has, Apple, however, doesn't license those technologies to us and doesn't allow us to actually build a great proposition using that technology.
Yeah, I think that's a good point I was going to bring up a little bit later, but I'll bring it up with you now. Does the initial availability to Mac users of streaming-only content have anything to do with the fact that there are few digital rights management solutions to protect content from copying for the Mac platform versus Windows?
It is obviously part of the equation. I mean, there's a variety of things that are in the mix as to why things were decided to go down this path. But I think your point is a very good point. Right now, the availability of copyright protection or DRM systems that the copyright holders trust is very limited on non-Windows platforms. And I think, in fact, I believe that's an opportunity for the industry to jump into and make those available. I think once copyright holders get, you know, more, let's say, comfortable with other DRM technologies, then, you know, the BBC would be happy to adopt those technologies and make available its services using that way.
I mean, I guess you could say that some of the blame has to be laid at the door of the program makers and not the BBC because a few Mac-based DRM solutions. Would you agree?
Well, I don't know if that's 100% true, but what I do know is that, you know, a lot of the BBC's output is not directly owned by the BBC. And as such, the agreements that we have with those copyright holders to provide these services on demand via IP networks specifically talk about the need to protect that content using DRM systems. And so, you know, you could say that the copyright holders certainly play a role in that.
You've decided to use an off-the-shelf third-party player from Adobe that does streaming only for the Mac platform. A simple question, why?
Adobe, I think, I hope you would agree, is absolutely an industry leader when it comes to embedded media. They have been cross-platform from day one. They have the largest installed base of any of these sorts of solutions out there. They have publicly committed themselves to standards-based encoding technologies like H.264 and AAC, which are very important to the BBC. That's the path that we want to take, which, by the way, I think is very, very good for Mac users. And on top of that, Adobe was very keen to partner with the BBC to help out with things like accessibility. You know, the BBC has a special remit in that it wants to make sure that the visually and hearing impaired audience, which is sizable, can have a great experience with our services.
I want to better understand the reasoning for the BBC announcing this iPlayer for Mac. Your boss, Ashley Highfield, the BBC Director of Future Media and Technology, is quoted as saying that we need to get the streaming services up and look at the ratio of consumption between the services, and then we need to look long and hard at whether we build a downloadable service for Mac and Linux. He went on to say, quote, "It comes down to cost per person and reach at the end of the day. We are not ruling it out, but we are not committing to it at this stage," unquote. Now, I translate that to mean that the BBC has the Mac and Linux platforms will generate a substantial number of users to spend the money on full development like they did for Windows. Would that be correct?
I don't think that is correct, and I don't think it was exactly what Ashley said. You know, at the end of the day, if it is technically feasible and if the DRM solutions are out there that are available on those platforms, the BBC is very committed to being universally available. In fact, you know, we are launching BBC iPlayer on the Virgin Media cable network, and we are in discussions of looking at BBC iPlayer and making it available on all sorts of mobile devices. So we have no interest of it not being available on platforms that have a significant amount of our users.
Okay, let's talk about the user experience of streaming versus downloading, because the Mac users immediately are going to be doing streaming only. I would venture to guess that those who are listening to this program right now have at one point or another visited the BBC's news website, streamed a news report, and probably had that streaming content bogged down on them at one point or another, or just stopped streaming altogether because of a variety of issues related to maybe upload and download reliability. So would you agree that streaming isn't as good of an experience as downloading a program and watching it from your local hard drive?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I've worked in this industry for many, many, many years. In fact, I've been working in the digital media space for almost over a decade. And I think that networks, broadband availability has become such that streaming is absolutely extremely popular and is becoming increasingly reliable. I mean, companies like Juiced, you mentioned them before, completely are betting their entire business on streaming being their sole way of offering video. If you look at YouTube, I mean, it is just streaming, as far as I can tell. And so basically, I think that with broadband capabilities out there being what they are, with encoding technologies being improved, you know, upon all the time, with the adoption of H.264 and AAC, I think that basically provides a new opportunity for better experience. I'd much rather have instant gratification than wait for, you know, a 300, 400, 500 meg download. Instant gratification meaning you click and you watch it and you go full screen and you have a great experience.
Two final questions for you. When will the Adobe-made iPlayer for Mac be available?
This will be available before the end of the year. We are hoping somewhere around the Christmas time frame.
Finally, when specifically will the BBC reassess if there are enough users to warrant spending the public's license fee funds on a full downloadable service for Mac users? 12 months after you introduced the streaming-only version, 24 months, what?
Right now, all the time, 24/7. The teams are thinking about how can they make their service available across as many platforms as possible. I mean, we are absolutely constantly evaluating what our options are, whether it's technically feasible, whether we can actually make this happen, you know, rather sooner than later. So this is a constant process. We don't have some set date where we say, oh, 12 months from now, we'll think about it again. I think that would be completely misunderstanding. I have teams who are currently looking at all sorts of options to get us, you know, to platform universality.
Eric Huggers is the BBC's controller of the Future Media and Technology Group. He spoke to us from London. A postscript to our story, Mr. Huggers reacted to a quote from his boss, Ashley Highfield, during our interview, saying Mr. Highfield might have been misquoted. You should know that the quote was directly from a press release provided by the BBC. Secondly, Mr. Huggers joined the BBC in May of this year, having spent most of the past decade at Microsoft as Senior Director of Windows Digital Media. It's an all-hardware segment on this show as we recap three December product reviews from Mac Format Reviews editor James Allerbeck. James joins us now. Happy holidays to you, and welcome back to the show, James.
Happy holidays, Brad. Thank you very much.
Let's first talk about the three products that we're going to review. They all appear in the review section of the magazine beginning on page 83, and the first product is Apple's wireless keyboard. The second product is the Canon PIXMA IP4500 A4 inkjet printer, and finally the Griffin Amplify iPod speaker. And James, let's begin with the Apple wireless keyboard. Let's talk about the completely different styling of this keyboard. Describe for our listeners how this keyboard is different.
Okay, so compared to the previous wireless Apple keyboard, it's a lot thinner. It's just one 3 millimeter, perhaps half a centimeter slab of metal, and the keys are slightly raised up over this. At one end, it raises off the table. It raises off the table by the height of a little more than a AA battery. It's quite compact. If you've seen the wired version of the Apple keyboard, it doesn't have the number pad on the right. So it's quite compact. It sits on your lap really well, and it is a thing of beauty.
Yes, a very ergonomic and very good-looking, very high-tech type keyboard, very similar to the one of the wired keyboard that Apple sells, as well as the thin keys that you see on the Apple laptops. So you're losing some functionality in terms of the number of keys and also the fact that there are not USB ports on this wireless keyboard. What are you gaining?
Well, you're getting mobility, and you're getting something which is really easy to tuck away. It's a Bluetooth keyboard. I gave it a test of about 12 feet. It has some media browsing keys on it, so if you are on the other side of the room and you're watching something in front row, you can pause it or raise the volume or fast forward or browse around or eject media. But it just looks fabulous. It works really well. There's no gaps between the keys and the board that they're in, so you can't get crumbs of food down there unless you really make an effort to. It's just simple. It's just a lovely, simple bit of kit. I think out of everything I've seen Apple design over the last couple of years, it's the best thing, easily. It's wonderful.
So this new keyboard needs three AA batteries to transmit the data. So that begs the question, what kind of battery life do you get with this wireless keyboard?
Well, Apple says you get about 9 months. We reckon you get about 6 months. We tested the batteries in and out over a period of a month. And then what we lost, we reckon you're going to get about 6 months. But Apple always claims a little bit more, but perhaps they don't use it quite as much as we do. But I think 6 months is a reliable figure.
All right, the Apple wireless keyboard, a Mac Choice, 5 out of 5 stars. It cost about £49. Let's move on to product number two, and that's the Canon PIXMA IP4500. It is a budget A4 inkjet printer, costs about £70. That's where we found it. Consumers who look or own low-cost inkjets know you get very few features on these, James, but you found this printer is slightly a step above those that would be below, say, £60. Tell us what's different about this printer.
Just general build quality and ability. You get a lot of budget printers these days that the big players like the Canons, the Epsons, Lexmark are trying to sell in Tesco or trying to sell in the supermarkets, designed not to last particularly long. They're almost disposable printers. This one is a cut above those sort of bargain basement printers, which you get around the £30-40 mark. It prints very respectively. Sometimes the photos came out a little overexposed, but that was our only grumble, really. It was reasonably fast. We got 20 sheets of test text paper to print out in just under 9 minutes. There's no LCD and there are no card slots on it, so you couldn't take a camera card straight out of your camera, dock it onto the printer and fire away. But it's very easy to use. It's PIC bridge enabled, so that you can use a USB port from your camera, a USB link, and then use the LCD on the back of your camera as a browser instead. So that works fine.
So all in all, this is a very capable printer that actually puts out pretty good quality prints, even photo prints.
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, Canon's got their paper right and their ink right. They're reliable. It's a good printer for somebody who perhaps prints, maybe 5 sheets or 10 sheets a day. Isn't looking for a volume printer. Perhaps for a home or student type environment, it'd be a winner because it's not that expensive either.
Okay, so the Canon PIXMA IP4500, fast for the price, duplex printer, crisp text, great photos. It doesn't have an LCD or card slots, and you need to watch those ink costs you mentioned. 4 out of 5 stars for the Canon PIXMA IP4500. It cost around £70. And our final product to review is the Griffin Amplify. This is an iPod speaker system. You called it a middleweight speaker system with a huge amount of bass. At £95, this is a mid-priced iPod speaker system with an amplifier and a speaker system all in one unit. Tell us the basics of these features.
There's one single volume control on it. You get a remote to do your browsing. You can also control tunes just by rubbing your finger along the click wheel on your iPod. It's got speakers pointing out and one big speaker pointing directly down towards the desk. It's a brick-shaped box. It's 35 centimeters wide, so it's not particularly big. I said it was middleweight because it's not up near the build quality that you would see on an Apple Hi-Fi, which is £250, or a Bose Soundock, but it's also it's more solid than some of the real budget models you see.
So a very basic stripped-down unit. What is wrong with this product? What is it missing that comes in some of the little bit higher-range iPod speaker systems?
The prime consideration with any speaker is going to be sound quality. Because the speaker, the bass speaker, points straight down, it can rumble on the desk. I had it set up on my desk in the office right out of the box, and then I had it at home as well to test it out. People on the other end of, we've got 6 or 7 people sitting around one very large desk, the bass was just rumbling, you know, their coffee was sort of shaking in its cup. It is not a desirable feature. You want to have your bass tight and going towards your ears, not loose and going into the furniture. So you couldn't put it on a shelf, for example. So I thought that was a bit of a downside. It's got plenty of power, and I think somebody young who doesn't really care that much about proper audio profiling would have a lot of fun with it. It's okay. I mean, it wasn't too shabby, but it wasn't startling.
All right, so the Griffin Amplify, the pluses are it's inexpensive, it comes with a remote, it's got a very strong bass. The minuses of it needs careful positioning because of that bass speaker on the bottom, feature light, and the bass can be overpowering, as we've discussed. So the Griffin Amplify, 3.5 out of 5 stars. You can find it in the ballpark of £95. James, thanks so much for going over these three products. They are all great ideas for Christmas, by the way. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
James Ellerbeck is the reviews editor at MacFormat Magazine. This month's reviews begin on page 83. It's question and answer time on Mac Format this week with our resident fixer-upper, Trevor Middleton. Welcome back, Trevor.
Hi there, Brad. Thanks for that lovely intro.
Well, that's exactly what you are on this show to us. On every show, Trevor does his best to answer your questions, and you can send us your issues to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. We'll repeat that address at the end of the show, and please make sure to tell us not only your name, but very important, where you're from and how to pronounce your name. On this episode of our Q&A, we're concentrating on Mac OS X Leopard, as many of you are now installing it, and some of you have some questions and problems. So let's get right into question one, which is very timely. We've received a number of questions on this very problem, one which I encountered just a few weeks ago, and this email comes to us from Eric Sommerfeld in Edinburgh, Scotland. And he wrote us, "I'm installing Mac OS X Leopard on an older G5 iMac with plenty of hard drive space and memory. I performed an upgrade, and after it installed and restarted, all I get is a blue screen, and it will never launch into the Finder. So what do I do now?" Trevor.
Okay, well, Brad, there have been so many people with this problem that Apple has actually put up a new technical support document on their website outlining exactly what to do when this happens, and I'll give details of that document in a second or two. Essentially, the problems caused by third-party application enhancers, and Apple gives three methods of removing them in that document. Now, this type of clash is quite common with major system upgrades, so what I would recommend to anyone about to install Leopard for the first time is that as you're doing so, click on that options button at the bottom left-hand corner of the installer screen and choose archive and install. You will admittedly need a lot more disk space than you would for an upgrade installation, but you do get a clean copy of Mac OS X. You'll also, by the way, get a new folder called Previous Systems, which you can delete safely once you've checked it for any items you might need. So, finally, if you have a pen and paper handy, to get hold of that information from Apple, go to apple.com/UK/support and search for article number 306857. Brad.
And Trevor, what we'll also do is on our Enhanced podcast, you'll be able to get a direct link to this document. So look for that on the Enhanced podcast, which you can get from the iTunes store. Let's go right into question two from Bradley Turpin in Plymouth, who wrote us, I have a 12-inch iBook G4, and I can't work out if Leopard will work on it. Please, can you help me?
Okay, Bradley, I remember you sent us a question earlier this year, so hello again. Thanks for your question, and thanks also for sending me the serial number of your iBook, which is very, very helpful if anyone else wants to do that. Now, that serial number tells me that it's a late 2004 model G4 iBook and should have at least a 1.2 GHz G4 processor. Now, the minimum system requirement for Leopard is a G4 processor running at 867 MHz, plus 512 megabytes of RAM. So yes, your iBook will run Leopard as long as it has enough memory. However, I would say, based on my experience of running a single processor G4, you might have a problem running Leopard's more advanced features, such as the video effects in iChat. If you can live with that, then fine, go ahead, install Leopard.
All right, and finally, question three comes from Jerome Mecklenburg in Antwerp, Belgium, and he wrote us, I installed Leopard on my Intel iMac and appointed an external hard drive as my Time Machine disk. Later, I had to reformat my hard disk and reinstall Leopard before restoring my old files using the Time Machine backup. The problem is now that whenever Time Machine attempts to back up, the backup process stops and I get an error message. How can I solve this problem? Trevor.
Right. Now, Jerome, you should be able to carry on using those previous backups with your iMac, even though you've reinstalled Leopard. So there might be a problem with the way Time Machine was initially set up. So first of all, check that your hard disk, the external one that is formatted using the GUI dprt partition scheme. Otherwise, Time Machine will stop backing up when the disk contains about 10 gigabytes of data. Now, you'll find details of how to do that in Apple's technical support article number 306932. And by the way, for those of you with PowerPC Macs, your Time Machine disk needs to use the Apple partition map scheme. Next, Jerome, if you remember what your iMac was called before you reinstalled Leopard, check that it still has the same name. Otherwise, that can cause a problem with backups. You'll find your Mac's name in the sharing preference pane if you are going to System Preferences. And one final word of warning, Time Machine only likes computer names that have unaccented upper or lowercase letters or numbers. And don't, whatever you do, leave the name blank because that will cause problems too. Brad.
All right, Trevor, thanks for stamping out those Leopard issues. We'll see you on the next episode.
See you next time, Brad.
You can send us your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. Please tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Chris Finn, Eric Huggers, James Ellerbeck, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakalaropoulou. Join us again for our next edition as we deliver our Christmas present to you on Monday, the 24th of December. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Happy holidays to all of you, and thanks for joining us.